Hi, writers. Welcome to a new edition of our podcast on writing fiction, both novels and short stories. This is Jim Thayer. I'd like to talk about errors we writers can make when creating a scene. My favorite single book on writing fiction is by Jack Bickham, and it's titled Scene and Structure. You've heard me mention this book before. Jack Bickham has passed away, but he wrote 80 novels, and he taught writing at the University of Oklahoma, the beautiful campus in Norman, where I visited. He has a terrific list in the book Scene and Structure, headlined Common Errors in Scenes and How to Fix Them. I'll read the list one after another. There are 14 errors on the list. Then I'll return to mention some of Jack Bickham's comments and my own comments after each one. He subtitles the list Little Shop of Horrors. Here's Jack Bickham's list of scene writing errors. 1. Too many people in the scene. 2. Circularity of arguments. 3. Unwanted interruptions. 4. Getting off the track. 5. Inadvertent summary. 6. Loss of viewpoint. 7. Forgotten scene goal. 8. Unmotivated opposition. 9. Illogical disagreement. 10. Unfair odds. 11. Overblown internalizations. 12. Not enough at stake. 13. Inadvertent red herrings. And 14, phony, contrived disasters. Jack Bickham says, "Phew, a list of horrors if I ever saw one." And then he adds, "But luckily, you seldom make more than one of them in any given scene, and once you've been warned to watch out for them, you can avoid them all." That's Jack Bickham. Let's return to his list and talk about each one of them. It's an important, a very good list. The first one is too many people in a scene. Jack Bickham says this reminds him of the old Henny Youngman gag. A man holds his arm over his head and tells his doctor, "It hurts when I do this." The doctor says, "Then don't do that." Bickham's advice, if you have too many characters in a scene, take some of them out. And he clarifies, if we have more than two people in a lot of our scenes, we may need to think about it and start to delete them. That's Jack Bickham. Let me add, how do we know when there are too many people in a scene? First, ask the question, if there are too many people in a scene, when there are more than two characters in a scene. Usually scenes work best when there are only two characters in them. And second, we can ask, does this character contribute, or is she just background? If the scene makes as much sense without the character, we should likely leave her out. Jack Bickham's second error in scene creation is circularity of argument. He likens this to avoiding the children's argument of did not, did to, did not, which can go on endlessly. Jack Bickham says it's sometimes hard to avoid circularity when two characters are going at it. But if an argument seems endless, you can have the viewpoint character move on to another aspect of the argument or to another argument. I'll add, or just cut the scene shorter if it appears to repeat itself. You don't want arguments in a scene that go on and on. His third error are unwanted interruptions. And this may be related to too many people in the scene, because if they are in the scene, they'll have to do something in the scene. Otherwise, why are they in the scene? And that something is often interrupting. Jack Bickham says some of these interruptions, such as a knock on the door, are intended by us writers to make the scene more lifelike, but usually they just stop the forward momentum and may be confusing. Bickham says unless the interruptions play some direct, dramatic role in the scene, they should not be allowed to occur. Number four on his list is getting off the track. We writers want to introduce new angles, which is part of plotting, but Jack Bickham says we should be vigilant to the danger of getting off the track when introducing new angles, and or new maneuvers or new side issues. He says the main way of avoiding getting off the track is to make sure the scene goal has been stated clearly and succinctly. He says it's vital that the reader has a clear understanding of the scene question. Number five is inadvertent summary. A scene is played out as if on a stage, moment by moment. If we writers are truncating time with something that reads like a bullet point list, it's a summary. The sentence, "They argued about her driving the car," is a summary. "You don't need the car keys tonight," is part of a real-time scene. We want to avoid summary in a scene. Number six on Jack Bickham's list is a loss of viewpoint. The character with a point of view should keep the point of view in the scene rather than the point of view jumping from character to character. Sometimes, Jack Bickham says, the writer will forget which character has the point of view, or sometimes might accidentally put a thought or a feeling or a sense impression in someone other than the point of view character. He says we should look for possible slips. Keep the point of view with one character only visiting her head and no one else's. Number seven is forgotten scene goals. This is related to getting off the track. Here, Bickham means that not only does the action stray so that the reader forgets the goal, but the characters actually forget too. He says this is a manifestation of the loss of author control, and he offers this example. Our scene goal is Richard wants to get a promotion, and the disaster is Richard gets a bad migraine. The writer has forgotten the scene goal. Jack Bickham says that such illogical and reader-frustrating disasters can only occur when somebody has forgotten the scene goal. Both the author and the author's character have forgotten the goal. Number eight on Jack Bickham's list is unmotivated opposition. As we know, your hero, your protagonist, is more involving when he wants something badly. So is your villain. He or she, the villain, should also want something badly, and that usually is to foil the hero. We should make our villain highly motivated. Number nine on Jack Bickham's list is illogical disagreements. He says that these show a faulty vision by the author of why the antagonist is antagonistic. The villain should not put himself between the hero and the attainment of the scene goal just to be nasty, but rather he should have some background motivation for the opposition. Number 10 on the list, unfair odds. The antagonist should be strong enough to make the scene's conflict strong, so he must be formidable. But if he's too powerful, the reader won't believe the scene, so a balance is needed. The hero and the antagonist should roughly be with equal skill and equal motivation. Number 11, overblown internalizations. This is too much interior monologue, which I've talked about. It's also known as the character thinking, particularly navel-gazing, where, in Bickham's phrase, quote, the writer is straining too hard to divine precisely the emotional state of the viewpoint character. That's navel-gazing, overblown internalizations, and we should avoid it in our scene creation. Number 12, not enough at stake. Jack Bickham says the scene goal should be important to both the viewpoint character and the opposition. He says, quote, petty Insignificant goals lead to pale and puny conflicts. Always make sure the viewpoint character believes his scene goal is important, and make sure the reader knows that it is. That's Jack Bickham. Number 13 on his list, inadvertent red herrings. Readers are always looking for clues and trying to figure out which clues are real and which are red herrings planted there by the author, which red herrings are intentional misdirection put in the story by the writer. Jack Bickham says, don't put in any accidental false clues. Ones that the reader will think might be a clue or a false clue, but which are neither, because the writer has inserted them into the scene by accident. Number 14, phony, contrived disasters. Jack Bickham says we writers shouldn't add a disaster in our scene just to make something bad happen. He says readers are good at spotting phony plot disasters. He says a disaster should be logical. It might be unanticipated by the character and the reader, but it should be logical. It should make sense. He says, quote, it's a hard job to conceive a scene goal that will lead to a tough conflict and end in a disaster that's not only unexpected, but after a moment's reflection by the reader, entirely logical. Doing it well is a fine art of creative legerdemain. The fact that it's difficult should not discourage you, Jack Bickham says. The more you work at contriving good disasters, the better and more imaginative you will become at it. That's Jack Bickham's list called The Little Shop of Horrors, where he talks about the 14 errors we writers can make when constructing a scene. He is spot on, and I like to be reminded of these faults, hoping to avoid them when I read the list. I received a question from a listener, Manny. He said, can you make an episode on how to avoid beginning our sentences with a pronoun or a name each time? Manny says, using the active voice and focusing on action, I find myself writing repetitive sentences. Tom grabbed the gun. He wiped the sweat from his brow. He checked over his shoulder, and upon seeing the police lights, he broke into a sprint. He tripped over a root. And so forth. That's from Manny, and it's a good question. You've heard my formula for a good sentence. Subject, strong verb, few modifiers, and not too long. Tom grabbed the gun. Manny's example sentence is a good sentence. A lot of our sentences should be like this one, but if we use this formula sentence after sentence, it'll start to sound like a metronome. What can we do to avoid the plainness of sentence after sentence like this? Well, there's a lot of things. The first is to vary the length of the sentences. Shorter sentences are percussive, and they're easy to understand, and they give energy to the story. Longer sentences are smooth and can be lyrical and even restful. Varying the length of a sentence offers the benefit of contrast. The shorter sentence will be even punchier if preceded by a longer sentence. Tom grabbed the gun. He lifted his holster to check the rounds on the belt and through the window saw Smith climbing down from the stagecoach. That's a short sentence followed by a longer sentence. Mixing up the sentence length avoids the 1-2-3 1-2-3, 1-2-3 metronome pattern. A second way to do it is to use different types of sentence. Tom grabbed the gun is a simple sentence. You might precede it with an independent clause. Stepping back, Tom grabbed the gun, which makes it a complex sentence. Or extend the sentence with an independent clause. Tom grabbed the gun, stepping back. These additions make the sentence sound less like a metronome. Or you could use a compound sentence. Tom grabbed the gun and he lifted his coat from the rack. Or how about a compound complex sentence? Tom grabbed the gun and he lifted his coat from the rack, eyeing the mirror behind the bar. A third thought, most sentences should be in the active voice, particularly in action scenes. Tom grabbed the gun is an active sentence. To vary the sentence patterns, once in a while we can use a passive sentence. Passive sentences change the cadence of the paragraph they're in, and they are appropriate when a person is being acted upon. Sometimes a passive voice is useful when it's expressing a sense that the character is being acted on. If Jones is being mugged, then Jones was punched by the mugger, which is a passive sentence, which reinforces that Jones is being acted upon. The active version of the sentence, the mugger punched Jones, would also be good, but here Jones is receiving the action, being punched, so the passive form emphasizes his trouble. Throwing in a passive sentence once in a while will counter the steady drumbeat of short active sentence after short active sentence. So those are some thoughts on avoiding Manny's problem of too steady a drumbeat in his sentences. I'd like to talk more about showing versus telling. It's such a critical skill that I return to it again. Showing engages the reader better than telling. Showing presents evidence, while telling is simply the author offering a lecture. Showing reveals while telling explains. We should always ask as we write, is there evidence? He scratched his arm is showing. It offers evidence that his arm itches. His arm itched is telling, which is the writer simply announcing it. Showing an itchy arm is easy to do. But how about a character's personality? Showing personality isn't hard either, with just a little thought. She was expressive is telling the reader about her personality. It's the writer's little lecture about the character, and it doesn't create an image, and it isn't interesting for the reader. How can we show she's expressive? When she saw him, she rose from the table, waved at him with both arms, and laughed. Isn't that a nice image? And it shows the character is expressive. How can we show a character is spontaneous? She looked at Emily. Let's skip our book club. A band is playing at Jilly's bar. Let's go. Isn't that nice dialogue? And it shows, rather than tells, that she's spontaneous. Here is telling. She was filled with energy. That's a boring sentence of telling. How do we show that? When the bell rang, Diana threw her history book into the drawer, leaped out of the chair, and raced to the playground. That shows Diana is filled with energy. How can we show our character is compassionate? Another personality trait. The envelope had the Red Cross's address on it. Colin pushed the check into the envelope, then licked the flap and sealed it. Honey, I'm walking out to the post office box. That shows Colin is compassionate. How about showing a character is charming? Well, we could say Matthew is charming, but that's telling. It's not very interesting. How about this showing? Matthew took the old lady's hand. Lisa has told me all about you, Mrs. Smith. I'm delighted to meet you. Matthew reveals he's charming in his own action and words. How about showing someone's irresponsible? We could say Wilson was irresponsible. That's telling, and it's dull. How about this showing? Wilson tilted his head back and drained the whiskey bottle, some of it dribbling down his chin. He fished in his pocket and pulled out his Corvette key. Well, that's showing Wilson's irresponsible. How about showing someone's deceitful? Honey, I've got to work late. I won't be home much before 9. He put away the cell phone and pushed himself through the door to Jilly's bar. That's showing he's deceitful. How about showing our character is easily smitten? We could tell he was easily smitten, but that is giving up such a nice way to show, such as this. Through the window, sunlight streamed in at the girl in the second row, lighting her as if she were on a stage. Dawn didn't know her name. When the teacher asked a question about Shakespeare's Richard III, the girl raised her hand and spoke of ambition and treachery. Dawn, on the other side of the room near the door, stared at her, blinked, and stared some more. That shows Dawn is easily smitten. The girl wants to talk about Shakespeare, the Richard III, and his play Richard III, and all Dawn can think about is how nice she is or how cute. He's easily smitten. How about showing, rather than telling, that someone is gullible? Okay, what was your name? Sure, you can use my cell phone. Yeah, go ahead outside where it's quiet. I'll be right here when you're done with it. Well, that's showing plainly that this character is gullible. How about you could tell that someone was dangerous? He was a dangerous person. Or you can show this personality trait. He dribbled 3-in-1 oil on the sharpening stone, tilted the 6-inch blade at a precise angle, then slowly brought the knife back and forth along the stone, making a rhythmic scratching noise. That shows this person dangerous. How about the personality trait of being agreeable? Well, we could tell he was agreeable, or we can show. Sure, he replied, doesn't matter to me what you do. How about showing someone's polite? That's a personality trait, a good one. We could say he was polite, which is telling, or we can write, he waited until the 3 elderly women passed through the door before going through. That's a nice image, and it shows he's polite. How about showing she has a sense of humor? We can say our character, she had a sense of humor, which is telling, and it's boring. Or we can write, she turned in her seat so the class could see her and dramatically raised an eyebrow. They all laughed. Why would the class laugh? Because she's known to be funny, and they anticipate humor in whatever she does or says. In the context of the scene, this will be clear. It's such a nice image, too, a nice image. How about the personality trait of being honest? Here's how we can do that. We can say she was honest, which is dull and it's telling. Or we can write, ma'am, he tapped the woman on the shoulder, you were digging in your purse and this $20 bill fell out. He handed it to her. Isn't that a nice image? And it shows the reader that our character is honest. We could tell about this personality trait. She was intelligent. Well, how dull is that telling? How about this for showing? She placed her coffee cup on the table and opened Loomis and Sternberg's book, Advanced Calculus. She turned to the chapter on infinite series and settled into the lounge chair. Well, I've never done that once in my life, but this shows our character is intelligent. Who reads Advanced Calculus for fun? Sounds like punishment to me, but not for someone like our character here. Aren't these better? Aren't these showing versions better than the telling versions? Each instance where we have shown rather than told of a personality trait, we've offered an image, some action, to give evidence to the reader of a personality trait. Letting the reader deduce the personality trait from the evidence we writers offer involves the reader, and it brings her into the story. It's such a strong technique. My new novel, Fagin and Miss Havisham, has been released and is available at Amazon. The novel takes place in London in the 1820s, and its characters are Charles Dickens's famous characters from many of his novels. Fagin and Bill Sykes from Oliver Twist, Miss Havisham from Great Expectations, Murdstone from David Copperfield, and many others. They are younger than in Dickens's novels, and I toss them together to see what happens. The publisher is Creative Texts, an independent publisher and a good one, and I'm delighted. I had huge fun researching and writing the novel. I tried to take readers back to London 200 years ago, and I hope you'll consider getting a print or ebook copy. You'll be able to see whether I can actually do the writing techniques we talk about in these episodes. The title again is Fagin and Miss Havisham. Thank you. My cat Jack has just jumped onto the desk and has aimed himself at my chin. Why? It's 15 seconds after 12 o'clock noon, and he wants lunch. I'm allowed a 15-second grace period. I wanted a cat, but I got a clock. So I'm headed downstairs to serve him lunch. And so we've come to the end of this episode. If you'd like to send me a message, my email address is jimthayerseattle@gmail.com. I hope to see you here next time. And until then, this is Jim Thayer. Please keep tapping those keys.